Good afternoon. So, last time we discussed the idea of registers. We mentioned that, well, when we want to have circuits that do one thing after another, we had like our counter example. We can't just take the wire coming from something that does a calculation and feed it back into itself directly or indirectly, because we have this problem with transient values, that when values are changing, the result of our calculation circuits is going to be unpredictable. So we want some way of making sure we have predictable results and moving from one step to the next in a predictable fashion. And our solution is going to be have something that stores a value. And our main component for doing that is going to be registers. So these registers, they're outputting a stored value from their single output. And they change that stored value based on this clock signal. And in our design, we're going to have one common clock signal for all the components in our processor. And that clock signal is going to have this rising edge periodically. And that's going to signal the registers to store a new value and start outputting something else, therefore. So the way our processor is going to work is that we're going to be having our registers output some value that's going to feed into circuits that do some computation on that value and produces the next set of register values. And once those next set of register values are ready, our clock signal will have a rising edge and we'll proceed to the next step. So we'll use the current values to compute the next ones. We'll have a rising edge of the clock to advance to the next values and start computing the values after the next ones, and so on. So we had our registers to do our step-by-step computation. And we started looking at, well, let's start implementing instructions. And one issue we ran into is that, well, we have a lot of places where we want to make decisions between instructions, where we want to do one thing for one instruction and one thing for another. And we need some sort of equivalent of like an if-then in this circuit design. And the big component we used to represent that is what we called muxes. So this was something that kind of looks like a gate that takes in a bunch of inputs and a selector signal, and has one output, which, based on that selector signal, chooses one of that bunch of inputs. And we mentioned that in our hardware programming language, HCL, we're going to have this super abstracted version of that, that we're going to assume that someone else can solve the problem of how do I go from the conditions at which you want each input to a circuit that produces the correct selector input. So our representation is going to be this case expression where we have a list of if condition, choose this output. If condition, choose this input to output, if condition, choose this input to output, and so on. And we're going to assume someone else does the work of translating that into a circuit that actually uses this MUX component we talked about. So we had our way of making decisions, and we wanted to make our decisions often based on the instruction that we were executing. And this meant we had to retrieve the instruction. So the instruction was stored somewhere, and we had to get it. So how did we do that? So we had a second type of storage, which was our instruction memory. So our instruction memory, unlike our registers, we have to put in an address to know where to get data from. And the way the instruction memory we're going to use works is that we input an address, and we get out of the instruction memory from on a different set of wires the value at that address. And this would be within the same clock cycle. And for our processor, we're going to always read 10 bytes. You might say, wait a moment. You know, we were dealing with nop and halt last time. Those are one byte instructions. Why would we read 10 bytes? Isn't that a waste? And, well, I think, yeah, maybe it's a waste. But if we wanted to read a variable number of bytes, to figure out how many bytes to read, we need to look at the instruction anyways. So rather than worry about that, we've chosen that we're just always going to read 10 bytes, the maximum we need to read. And if we read more than we need, well, too bad. We'll just not use all of it. But this saves us having some sort of complicated logic which reads the first part of the instruction, then figures out how much to read. So instead, we'll just always read enough. And yeah, sometimes we're reading stuff we don't care about. That's fine. So then we went into using these components to build a CPU that does nop or halt. So to do this, we had a MUX that decided what to send for our stat signal, our simulator control, do we keep going or not, based on the opcode part of the instruction. And we mentioned that because when we read our 10 bytes, we're reading it as a little endian number. Well, the opcode part of the instruction, if we remember our instruction diagram, it was in the most significant bits of the first byte. The way we numbered bits, that turns out to be bits 4 through 8. Not what many people would guess of 0 through 4 or like 76 through 80. It's 4 through 8. So questions about these things we covered last time before I on a bit. Yes, back there. So the I-10, what is the I-10 byte signal? So we read 10 bytes, and this 10 bytes here is called I-10 bytes in HCLRS. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yes. So question, if I have a mux and I want to, if none of the conditions are met, not change the value we're assigning to, can I do that? So your premise is that we can assign to a value and change it. But that's not really how assignments in HCLRS work. So if I do something like, x equals something y and something x, so like if, and these are square brackets, so this is a mux, that's an error. And can someone tell me why that's an error? What's the problem with this? Why will HCLRS refuse to run that? Something we went over when we started talking about circuits. Yeah.
You have a loop in your circuit?
We have a loop. We have one of those circular dependencies that our value x depends on itself. So if we think of building this circuit, we have this sort of transient value problem, right? That as x is changing, we're using x to compute itself, and we might have unpredictable behavior. So this is not allowed. So this is a circular dependency because we have x and x. So that's a circular dependency. So that's not allowed. So if we're having a value that's computed using itself, we can't really do that. So there's things we can do. So one thing we could do is we could compute a value in multiple steps based on some values. So we'll see examples of that where we say, okay, I want a value which is the first register we want to use. So I'm going to compute a value called first register, which is going to be based on something else. And the default case will be bytes 8 through 12 of the instruction, or bits 8 through 12 of the instruction, and there'll be some other cases. And we'll not use bits 8 through 12, but we'll use that other value. We also have the case of where we have a register. If we remember our PC value, we were computing the next value of the PC based on the previous one. But the reason why this worked is that we aren't actually assigning directly a new PC value. We're giving a new input to the register, and that takes effect at a well-defined time. And I could have done that with a mux, too. We'll, in fact, do that later today. We'll do that with a mux. But to make that work, it matters that this lowercase p signal and this uppercase p signal are different things, right? They're different wires. And we're not going to have a loop in our circuit because we have this register deciding when to copy the value over. Does that answer your question?
I may have more questions later, but I'll wait for
you. Okay. So, but we'll see an example of setting our PC input based on where we have our default case and our not default case, which is probably mostly what you're thinking of doing. But note that we can't literally set a value to something or something else because that's not how this works. The value is set once. We don't get to set values multiple times because it's like connecting a wire. Once it's connected, you can't connect it again. That's not a meaningful operation. Okay, other questions? About things we covered last time. Okay. time we had our not halt CPU, and I gave a little demo, and something you'll note here is that we have this, we selected our I code, which is this I10 bytes 4 through 8. That was that primary opcode we saw in our instruction diagram. And I have these constants, nop and halt, that were predefined. You can look up the HTLRS write-up, which is linked at the top of the course website, to figure out all the possible constants. This is just instead of me writing 0B0000001, you know, which I could do, but you know, we'd have to look that up in the table to figure out what that is. And this is just to save you some time. So questions about our nop and halt CPU? Okay, so let's extend this to add jump. And why I'm choosing jump is because this is something where we're going to have to change our logic for the PC, where we're going to want to choose to either increment the PC by one or change it to a place we're jumping to. So I'm going to first sort of draw out what this looks like. And I'm going to do a preparatory step, which is that I know that I'm going to need to do something to change this circuit, which adds one to the PC, because we're going to have a different case. I'm going to say, well, you don't always want to add one. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to add a mux, because I know I need to make a choice here. I'm going to choose to either do the thing we were already doing, which was adding one, or to do a jump, to a jump program counter value. So we need to figure out, where does the jump program counter value come from? And if we remember our encoding table, well, the jump has this 8-byte field, which is the destination address. So we're going to get that by processing the output of the instruction memory. This is going to turn out to be one of those I10 bytes, some subset of it. And we're going to choose which one to do based on whether the I code, the primary opcode, says it's a jump or not. And for now, I'm not going to handle conditional jumps. We'll worry about that much later. Okay, so let's write this out. So here's our HCL code for this. And we have our, well, so first I should go through some names. So I've created some convenient signals here just to make it easier to read. It's kind of like variables. So I have iCode, which is our primary opcode. I have dest, which is the extracted destination field for a jump. And I have valp. You might say, why am I using that name? That's a horrible name. I agree. I'm using names that are consistent with the textbook, so when you read the textbook, you'll be able to correlate that with the slides. Our textbook uses names starting with val for 64-bit values and p for PC. So this is the next PC value. That's what our textbook calls it. We're just computing that for convenience, and we end up giving that as input to the program counter. And we have this mux that computes valp, and we have a case for nop. So if it's nop, we say, okay, it's going to be what the program counter register is outputting plus one, what we were doing before. And if it's jump, it's going to be this dest value, which is going to be bits 8 through 72 of the instruction. How do they figure out those bit numbers? I looked at the diagram we saw last time of the instruction encoding. And that all together is what makes up this mux. Now, something you may notice is that I have a default case. So in HTLRS, we require a default case. The textbook does not do this in their case expressions. We require it because we found that requiring this dramatically decreases the number of errors students have. And what I've done for my convenience is I made the default case have this value, which will be really obvious if it shows up in the output. So I will know what's going on rather than getting something weird happening and not knowing what's going on. Why is it going back to zero if I put zero there? Like, that would be confusing. This, at least, you know, I'll say, okay, that's a value that I must have put in there. It must be hitting this when I thought that wouldn't matter. And why did I think it wouldn't matter? Because I thought we'd always be halting the processor anyways. But if I was inconsistent, having that default there would help me catch that. Okay, so questions about the code here? Yes. Question, is i10 bytes predefined? Yes. So our components, like the instruction memory and a few more we'll talk about later, have predefined signals, like i10 bytes and PC. And in the HTLRS write-up that's linked off the course website, you can find a comprehensive list of all the predefined things. Other questions? Yes, back there.
Were you, so for DALP-E, when you're checking the equals for iCode, how does iCode like store those values of NOP and JXX?
So the question is, how are NOP and JXX stored in iCode? So iCode is a 4-bit value, and the 4 bits it represents are the 4 bits highlighted in blue here. Or not blue, sorry. The 4 bits highlighted in blue here. What I call the primary opcode. And NOP is the constant 1, and big JXX is the constant 7. Does that answer your question?
And are you just storing NOP and JXX somewhere, like in a stored file, or?
So the question is, where are NOP and JXX stored? So there are some, for your convenience, HTLRS has some predefined constants, so you don't need to constantly look things up in the instruction table. But I could have just written 1 and 7 instead. Like, that would also work. I just think it would be a lot less readable. Okay, other questions? Okay. So we can, right. So I believe I showed last time running this, so here I have a copy of the NOP jump CPU and a file with some NOPs and jumps and holds. And I can run this. So I take my NOP jump CPU and NOP jump.yo, and I can run it. I can look at what happens in each step, and I see the values of the registers, which we don't know how to set yet. We'll talk about that later today. I see the value of the, I should highlight on the screen that you can actually see, the value of the program counter register, the value we passed in the instruction memory, and a decoding of what was read there. Now, this decoding might not be what you actually execute, just showing you for debugging. And I can see paging through this. So there's some other options that you can pass to HTLRS, which I'd like you to be familiar with. So one is that there is a debug option, which will show you at each step the values of all wires. So for example, if you were having a bug and you thought that maybe you were setting, you know, you weren't extracting the destination of your jump correctly, well, you can use this mode to figure out exactly what that value is. And things like that. Also, it gives you extra output on like what happens with built-in components. So here it's saying the value we read for i10 bytes is this number, hex 137010, that decoded as just NOP because, well, it's NOP in some extra junk that isn't as part of the next instruction, but this tells you like the full value that was actually read out from memory. Again, we can see this for every step. There's also an option, there's an interactive option, which is, if you add that, it just asks you to press enter after every cycle. You want to do that. I'd also mentioned that you can redirect the output to a file, like so. This will redirect the output to output.txt, so they can open up output.txt in a text editor later on and view whatever. I use Vi, but you can use a text editor that you find more convenient than that. Also, there's a quiet option. What that does is it only shows you the end. Okay. So questions about HTLRS usage in these debug options? just wanted to make sure we had seen, especially debug mode. Okay, right. And another thing to talk about is YAS. So our textbook authors have written, in addition to YAS, the sort of assemble to executable program you've used, hopefully, have a tool called YAS, which is a Y86 interpreter. So it is a reference implementation that does what the processor is supposed to do, at least according to our textbook authors. So I can run it, for example, on a.yo file, and it tells me what it's supposed to do here. It says it halts in 7 steps. That's not very interesting, but I can also, for example, run it on a file that changes registers. So this tells me that, oh, when you run this program, cmove xx.yo, it sets the registers RCX, RDX, which were initially 0, to ACE and X. And you can use this to figure out, you know, what was my processor supposed to do, even for a snippet of assembly you generate. Now, if I run the program I have my HCL processor on this, well, what's going to happen? I'm going to find out that it doesn't do that because, well, it didn't implement some of the instructions, so it just halts abnormally. And of course, I have nothing to change registers yet. But this is something that exists for you to like see what your processor should have done. And here we can find out it definitely doesn't do what it should have. Okay. So questions about YAS? So that's that. Okay, so we've seen about using HTLRS. So we saw that there's this bunch of registers that were in that output. So let's talk about using those. And to do that, I'm going to build another sample processor. So we built a processor that like just does jumps and nops. And I'm going to do a processor that only does adds. Because add is sort of the simplest instruction, maybe, you know, one of the simpler instructions that uses the registers. So I'm going to use this as an example of how to use the registers. And the way add is encoded, we have a 6-0 as our first byte. 6 was that primary opcode, 0 was that secondary opcode. Remember, we had a table, whether it was add, subtract, and so on. We're only going to care about add. And then we had 2 4-bit register codes. We have that table of register values. And this is what we're going to support. And for now, we're just going to care about supporting only adds. We're not going to have any other instructions in our program, just to keep things simple. And to do this, we need to access registers. And now, we could have you in the future, rather, implement sort of these registers yourself. You could define a register RAX, RBX, and so on, define muxes to control when they're set or not. Instead, we supply a built-in component called a register file, which implements that functionality that lets you select a register by its ID and read from it, or select a register by its ID and write to it. There's 2 reasons for this. So one is that if we're grading your processor, it's much easier to grade if we can examine register values than if we have to like infer by other behavior. The other reason is that, you know, this is some job that some electrical engineer could hopefully do for you and give you some good register file for you to use when you're making a processor. That in practice, like, that's sort of a component you get from elsewhere and use what kind of a, like a library when making a processor. So the register file that's built into HTLRS and that's discussed in our textbook looks like this from sort of an abstract point of view. We have 6 inputs and 2 outputs. So we have a pair of inputs for reading registers. So we have some inputs here where we put in a 4-bit register number, a register index, that's what we get from the instruction, and we get output and a corresponding output, a 64-bit value that's the current value stored in that register. So the timeline diagram is showing you if we put in a register number, which is the red value, after some time in the same cycle, we get the blue value, which is whatever value was stored in that register as the output. Okay. And so this looks very similar to our instruction memory, but rather than putting in a memory address, we put in a register index. Now, we also can write registers. So how does that work? So like normal, just raw registers, not a register file, the write's going to happen at this rising edge of the clock. But we have to choose which register to write. So we're going to have one input where we give the index of the register to write, and a corresponding input where we give what value to put in that register. And at the rising edge of the clock, the value specified on our value input will be written to the index of register with the index specified by our register number to write in input. And we have a pair of these. You might say, why do we have two of these? And it's because we have one instruction, pop, which writes to two registers. If we do pop RAX, we need to write to RAX and RSP. And we're going to want to do that, all the instructions in one cycle, so our register file can write two things at once in order to allow us to do that. And as for why can we read two registers, well, we think of add. We need to read from two registers to execute that instruction. So we have two register numbers to read and corresponding outputs. And commonly, this sort of pair of register number to read and output and register number to write and input are called read ports and write ports. And different register files might have different numbers of them. Based on the instructions that we're implementing, our textbook authors went with this design with two read ports and two write ports. Okay, so questions about our register file design? Yes. Question, do these registers have asynchronous reads? So I'm not sure what you mean by asynchronous reads, but the reads happen based on you putting in an input, not based on the clock signal, if that's what you mean. Yes. Other questions? Okay. So there's one thing that we haven't handled here, which is kind of important, which is that with this design, well, we're going to connect something to the register number to write signal, and we're going to connect something to the data to write into that register signal. And that means that we're always going to be writing something every time there's a rising edge of the clock to some register. And we don't actually want to do that. If we're executing an op instruction, we kind of don't want to actually write to any registers. So a register file is going to have a feature where register number 15, which remember we didn't implement, we just said there's no register 15, we're going to use that to represent no such register. That if you try to write to register 15, this register file will just silently ignore it. And if you try to read from register 15, it will just give you zero instead of a real value. And in HCLRS, you can use the constant reg underscore none to represent 15, if you like, or you could just write 15. I would write reg none, so it's clear what my code is doing, but you know, it's just equivalent to writing 15. And I showed you sort of these singles abstractly. These all have names in HTLRS, which I've shown here. So our register number to reads are source A and source B, with have corresponding output A and output B. Our register number to write is dest D and dest M. So these source, dest, and destination are 4-bit signals, because we have 4 bits of the instruction to specify the register index. And we have our input and output are 64-bit signals. The inputs are the ones we set. The outputs are the ones that the register file gives us. You might say, wait, why is it E and M? So A and B make sense, right? First and second register. Why E and M for writing? So the logic in our textbook for these names, which we're just copying from our textbook essentially, is that E is for execute or computation, and M is for memory. Now, you don't actually have to use them that way. They're just, you know, you can put whatever, you connect whatever you want to the E or M signal. We don't care. We just care that you have the right values in registers. But that's why our textbook named them this way. Questions about our register file. Okay, so let's use this to construct a CPU that runs add instructions. So to run our instruction, we're going to need to first retrieve it from the instruction memory, and we're going to split it up into its pieces. And in particular, when we split it up, we want to get the two register indexes from the instruction. and we're going to send them to the register file so we can read the two registers we're writing. So we're going to have them as those register number to read inputs, and then we're going to add those together. And well, once we add them together, we want to write that. So we're going to send the sum into the input indicating the value to write, and we're going to send the register to write to. Well, it's going to be the same as source B, the second register from the instruction, as the destination to write to. Okay, so questions? Yes.
Earlier we had two destination registers, but
the question is, when would we use both desti and destem? So there's one instruction where we have to use both, which is pop, because pop writes to two registers. So either we need to execute pop in multiple cycles, which is not what we're going to do, or we need to have two destination registers. For all the others, we only need one, but you could choose to mix and match them if you want. Other questions? Okay. So if we think of this, let's say we're writing this little program here, at RAX RDX, at RBX RDX, and initially our program counter is 0, RAX is 10, RBX is 20, RDX is 30. What we'll do in the first case is that we'll retrieve this first instruction, so we'll get the register index for RAX as source A, the register index for RDX as source B, and that happens to be 0 and 2. I just looked it up in the table we saw with the instruction encoding earlier. So you get the value of RAX and RDX coming out of the register file. We add those together, and so the input to the register file before the rising edge of the clock is 40 and 2 for the register index to write to. So after that first rising edge of the clock, we get 40 in RDX. Now, there's something missing here. Can someone tell me what that is? What are we missing? Yeah?
The add one.
We're missing the program counter manipulation. And you said the add one. So adding one is not going to work because the encoding has one, 2 bytes for this instruction, so you better not add one. Instead, we want to add two. Because this is not like our NOP or HALT instruction, which were 1 byte, this is a 2-byte instruction. Okay, so that gives us code like so. So you can see in here, we have our usual PC register. We have our add 2 because our adds are 2 bytes. We have our reading from the instruction memory. Remember, the input's called PC. We extract the different parts into just names for convenience. So opcode RA, RB, just the different bits of the instruction. And I connect to our register input numbers to read RI and RB, I connect to our destination register RB and do the addition, connect the result of the addition to our input to write. So not shown here is setting stat, but we have to do that. And not shown here is also dealing with destem. And you might say, don't we have to do that? If you don't specify destem, it defaults to regnon for you, which is usually what you want. Same with if you don't specify desti. Some questions about this add processor? Yes? So the question is, will the two write ports be in use for this? So for this, we only need to write one register at a time, so we only use one write port. So our register file has both write ports. So the universe of all register files, we could have register file designs with, you know, any number of read ports and any number of write ports. And as we'll learn much later in the semester, a typical modern processor's register file probably has many, like, 8-ish read ports and 4-ish write ports, but it varies. Yeah. Can I repeat what I said about DestDam? So you might be concerned, wait, I didn't set DestDam. Don't I need to do that? And the answer is that it defaults to RegNon for you, just for your convenience.
And same with Desti.
And same with Desti. If you don't use Desti, it defaults to RegNon for you. Okay. Other questions? RegNon, the number 15, which doesn't indicates don't actually write any register. Other questions? Yeah.
So what's going on behind this that takes our, what we input for like reg input E, for instance, and like actually assigns it to a register?
So what's going on that actually assigns it to a register? So you mean like in a physical implementation of this, or as far as our simulator works?
As far as the simulator.
So as far as the simulator works, the simulator is going to compute all the values of the wires based on what's coming out of registers. So what's coming out of a register is the PC register. So we use that to compute every value on wires. And once we've done that, we say, now we're going to have a rising edge of the clock, and we're going to actually write things. And what things do we get to write in this case? Well, the PC can write stuff, and the register file can write stuff. So both of those are going to happen at that rising edge after we've computed all the values. Once we do that, we go to the next step. We say, now with the new outputs, what do we get? Does that answer your question?
Yes.
OK, other questions? OK, so we've gotten pretty far into HCL. So some things I'd like to note that are different from the book, just so you can read the book. Our book, rather than calling things wires, which is what we do for any sort of, you know, variable-like signal, they call, use bool or int, depending on whether it's one bit or more than one bit. We just don't have that distinction. We just, you know, kind of generalize them. The book uses names like VALC, and they have their own naming convention. I will generally be relatively consistent with that name, but in the book's implementation of HCL, students had to use those names. Those names were fixed, and they had to use them. You can use whatever you like. So if you think VALC is a stupid name and I should use constant from instruction instead, go ahead and use constant from instruction and have your code be maybe more readable. We require boxes to have a default case. The textbook doesn't. So that's just going to be a difference in the code you see. In the textbook, they gave students an implementation of an ALU. We haven't actually talked about what an ALU is. So an ALU stands for Arithmetic Logic Unit. It's a component that you use to do computation. So the sort of abstract way an ALU works is that you take in, say, a value, two values A and B, and a select operation signal. And based on the select operation signal, this ALU will like perform an addition, subtraction, XOR, multiply, whatever arithmetic-like operation you like. And they supply one of these to their students and just said, you have to use this to do computations. We're not going to supply one. If you want this functionality, you can implement it. You can do like ALU result is the output of a mux, where if op select is, say, 0, we do A plus B. If op select is 1, we do A minus B, and so on. So you can implement one yourself with a mux. If you take an EE course, you might learn that maybe there's more efficient things to do, because, like, for example, add and subtract probably should share more logic. But this will be sufficient for our purposes. So we're not going to, like, supply you with one. Now, when you think of an ALU in a processor, you might say, so this is where all the arithmetic happens, right? So, you know, so if we have one ALU, we do one piece of arithmetic at a time. And our processor is going to have one ALU in the textbook's design. But it doesn't do all the arithmetic. There's some arithmetic which is not going to be done in the ALU. So for example, PC increment. You might say, well, this ALU, we need to implement adding for the add instruction. So why don't we just use that for the PC increment? Why have something else to do it? And there's two reasons. So one is that we'd like to do our add instruction in one cycle. And our add instruction, we need to do the add two and the actual addition of the register values. You add two of the PC, addition of the register values. That's two in the same cycle, so we're going to want to have two different adders. So one of the adders, the adder for the PC, it's not going to be an ALU probably because we don't need it to support all the types of arithmetic. We just need it to do adds and just small adds. So that could be a simpler circuit. So that's going to be a more specialized circuit. Questions about ALUs? Yes.
This isn't about ALUs, but you mentioned boxes need a base case or a default case.
Yeah.
Would it be a syntax error that the compiler will say if there is one, or will it just run?
The question is, what happens if you don't give a default case in HTLRS? Yes, it will refuse to run and will give you a compiler error. Other questions? Okay, so let's think about our add CPU. So we implemented addition here, and let's say I wanted to combine with this our previous Knopp and Holt CPU. So I want to add support for Knopp and Holt to the add CPU. So we have, a way to halt the processor, which we didn't before, and Knopp instructions. So I want to make basically an add plus Knopp CPU. Where do I need muxes to implement this? So my strategy for adding it is going to be, there's some places where I don't have muxes, where I'm not making a decision. I just have something hardwired that I'm going to need to change to be some sort of if-then with a mux. So which of these are they going to need? I'll give you a minute or two. You can discuss with your neighbors if you like. Okay, who'd like some more time? Okay, so who thinks A is a place where we need MUX? A couple people. B. Okay, small number of people. C. Okay, a bunch of people. D. A few people. And E. Okay, so why don't we go in order? So for A, so the logic you'd have here is that, well, add reads from registers and NOP doesn't. So I get the idea that, okay, so if we're doing a NOP instruction, we don't want to read any registers. But this isn't really needed, because if we read registers and don't use the values we read, it's harmless. So we don't really need a MUX there. I don't blame you for wanting to put one there. And, you know, maybe in some register file designs, it wouldn't be like completely harmless to read registers. Like maybe it would have a power impact or something, but probably, you know, not really needed. Because, you know, if we read a value and don't use it, doesn't matter. B, so few people chose B. So if we remember our instruction encodings, NOP is 1 byte, add is 2 bytes. So we need to add 1 when it's an op and 2 when it's an add. So we better have something in front of the PC register input to do that. So we're going to have to, so we're going to want something where we do, you know, have plus 1, plus 2, we have our 2 inputs, and we choose which one to use for the PC. So we're going to want a MUX, or something like a MUX, you know, in front of the PC register's input. As for option E, the instruction memory's address input, you know, with this design, we're still going to be taking a stored instruction address and reading the instruction there. So we're not going to need a MUX there. That's going to work the same way, regardless of whether it's an op or add. Like, we're still going to read the instruction from the instruction memory based on what's in the program counter register. So we're not going to need one in front of the instruction memory. It's going to be in front of the PC register. So questions about that so far? Why we probably don't need one for the source signals, and why we would want one for the PC register input. Yes, back there. I haven't gone over C and D yet. I'm asking about the ones I've gone over so far. Yeah.
Can you explain E again?
Can I explain E again? So the instruction memory's address input is what instruction do we want to read from memory? And we figure out what that instruction is from the PC register. We don't have any use any other information, and we can't really because, well, we haven't figured out what kind of instruction it is until we've read it. So it's adding more instructions is not going to change that logic. Support for more instructions. Not going to change that logic, still the same. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay. So then we have C and D. So the NOP instruction, what register does it write to? Doesn't write to any. But if we think of using our add CPU for that, in the add CPU, there's going to be a signal on here if we don't do something about it. You know, there's going to be something there. And we have to do something about that because there's going to be something there and there's going to be something here. And you might say, wait a moment, there's no register number in the NOP instruction. There sure isn't. But the NOP instruction, well, whatever's in memory over here, that's what's, unless we do something, that's what's going to be sent to the register file. And it's going to have something there, and it's probably not going to be the most convenient value. So we need to do something to fix that. So the simplest solution, I think, is we can add a MUX here and choose regnum, which remember was the 15 value, to indicate not to write anything. And if we do that, if we select that regnum, that 15, it doesn't matter that there's some weird value on this signal, so we don't need a mux in front of the input value there, because it just won't be used. Because that will just be ignored. Now, an alternate strategy that is valid, but I don't really recommend, is that we could instead put a mux here and wire it up to the register we're writing. So what we'll do instead of not writing anything is we'll write to RB the value we just read from RB. That would be another approach. That would avoid a mux in front of dest D and have a mux in front of the next value to write instead. So questions?
Oops. That is okay. No, okay. So for our exercise, you'd want to do one of C or D, probably C, in order to make the knock instruction not write to a register or some value. So questions? Exercise. Okay. Seeing, yes.
Why are we using the inputs instead of the outputs for registers?
So why am I using inputs instead of outputs? So when I say register file inputs, from the register's perspective, it's an input. Register file's perspective, it's an input. It's going into the register file. Does that answer your question?
I was thinking about, like, if you want to use what the current value of the PC register is, why are we using the input instead of the output?
The question, if for the PC register, why are we using the input instead of the output? So if we look at our add circuit, the input is where we selected the new value. And that's what we care about. That operation is what that question's asking about. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay. So we have our not been added CPU. So let's implement some other instructions. So next I'll talk about doing our move to register instructions. So these are all the instructions that move into a register. And this is going to involve accessing a value from memory. You might say, okay, so we have our instruction memory, we're just going to use that, right? And the answer is going to be no. And the problem with using the instruction memory is that we're already using it to read the instruction, and we can't at the same time be reading something else. We have to like do it in two separate cycles. And we're going to use a design where we do every instruction in one cycle, including this MR move queue. So we're going to need a second memory called the data memory. And the data memory supply is going to work a little differently because it's going to support writing. So we're going to have the same way for reading. So for reading, we'll put an address into the data memory, like we put an address into the instruction memory, and we'll get output the value at that address in the same cycle. So this is sort of, we input an address that's this red value, we get the value at that address, the blue value, after some delay, but in the same cycle. For our data memory, this is going to be controlled by a read-enable signal. There's also going to be a write-enable signal, so we set the read-enable signal to 1 if we want to read, otherwise we're not going to read. This data memory is also going to support writes, because we have some instructions, which we're not getting to yet, but we're going to need to, that do writes. So the way that works is similar to how the register file works. You put an address we want to write to, kind of like we put an index of a register we want to write to, and a value to write, and at the rising edge of the clock, the write actually happens. The value in memory changes. So questions about the functionality of our data memory. And all these signals have names in HTLRS that are built in. You can look these up on the documentation that's linked from the HTLS tab at the top of the website. Or you can look up this slide. Now, you might say, wait a moment, we have two memories, so does that mean our code is stored separately from our data? So in 1864, many real processors, we have this separate data instruction memory sort of at the processor level, but writing to an address in the data memory is going to change the corresponding address in the instruction memory. So they're synchronized in some way. And we'll talk in much more detail about how that works when we talk about caches. Because these memories, they aren't really memories, they're really caches, and we'll get to that when we talk about how caches work, what that really means. But they actually store the same values, they're coordinated in some way, even though they're going to be in a typical processor, physically separate components. So we want to implement these three instructions. So if I want these three instructions, where do I want muxes? Give you a minute or two to think about this question. So do I want, am I going to need muxes for this in front of the register indexes, the register index to read or write signals of the register file? I'm going to need muxes in front of the register value inputs, in front of the PC registers input, so determining what the next PC should be, or in front of the instruction memory, determining where to read an instruction from. Yes?
So the register we're creating can only do these instructions, not add and not?
The question, the processor we're creating can only do these instructions? Yes. Okay, who'd like some more time? Okay, so who thinks we'll need muxes for A? Couple people. B. Okay, majority. C. Some people. And D. Okay, so we don't need for D, as you figured out, because, you know, we're doing the same, we're treating this instruction in the same way, no matter what it is. Doesn't, what instruction it is doesn't change that, because we don't know yet. So, and B, indeed, we do need to change the input, because we want to write a different value to OYY, depending on which instruction we're running. So we're going to need to have a choice between values computed in different ways, whether it came from a constant, or from the register file, for example. Now, the PC registers input. Sometimes, we're going to need to add different knocks to the PC, because this instruction is 10 bytes, this instruction is 10 bytes, and this instruction is 2 bytes. So we need to add plus 2 or plus 10, so we need something like a mux to control what goes into the PC. As for the register file index input, so you might say, okay, well, sometimes we need to read from register RxX, and we need to write to register OYY. That seems the same for all the instructions. As long as we're okay with reading registers we don't care about, it seems like we don't need any boxes. Now, if you were more careful, you would have noticed something a little subtle about our instruction encoding table, which is that the arrow move qtip instruction, RB, is there, and RA is the destination. Unlike these others, where RB is. So we're going to need a mux to handle that. If that wasn't true, the case. You might say, why did our textbook authors do that? Why did they decide RB should be that way? And that's to make MRMoveQ and RMoveQ compute the memory address to pass to the data memory in the same way. It's a compromise they made. So, as far as building this processor, the way I like doing this, I like going instruction by instruction and just adding things as we go. So first I'll start with how do we implement RMoveQ. So to do that, I need to read the instruction to get the register numbers. I extract the register numbers, and I know I'm going to want to read from the first one and write to the second one. I'll also read from source B just because I know it will come in handy later, but I didn't need to do that. From RB, that is. So I get the value of RA out of the register file, feed it back in. That's my RMoveQ instruction. Except I haven't implemented incrementing the PC. So then I'm going to say, okay, I want to add IRMoveQ. And I look at this and I say, what's not right for IRMoveQ? Well, IRMoveQ is basically the same except I want to write a different value. So if I want to write a different value, I'm going to need a mux to do that. And my mux is going to choose for IRMoveQ to write from the value from the register file. And for IRMoveQ, we're going to get the immediate, the constant from the instruction, and pass that through to the register file. Questions so far? And this is going to be this, probably this mux controlling our input to the register file that we promised, the data value. So then we need to do MRMoveQ. So here we need a bunch of stuff. So one thing we need is that O destination E, sometimes it's RA because of MRMoveQ, sometimes it's RB. So I need to choose that. And also I need the value I'm writing. Sometimes instead of, in addition to coming from a constant from the instruction, sometimes it needs to come from data memory. And we need to access the data memory at D plus the value of RB. So I need to take the value of RB and add it to our constant from the instruction, happens to be in the same place as it is for IRMoveQ, to produce the address to read from the data memory. Questions? What's added here? And I guess something I didn't write out explicitly is I remember we had that read enable signal earlier. So I need to also make sure that we enable reading from the data memory by setting that to 1, at least in the case we're executing an MRMoveQ instruction. Yes?
So the constant is going to the ALU as well?
So the question, the constant is going to the ALU as well? Yes, because we need the constant V comes from the same place as the constant D, right? They're just the same bits of the instruction memory output. So you use it both to write to a value if we're executing an IREMOVE queue, or to access memory if we're executing an IREMOVE queue.
So then the D would just go directly
through unchanged? So V goes through unchanged when we're executing IREMOVE queue, and D is used for the addition, but they're the same value because they're just the same bits of the instruction memory output. So if we're writing our HTLS code, we probably have one wire that's that value for no matter whether we're doing IREMOVE queue or IREMOVE queue. And if we're doing something like an IREMOVE queue, it just contains a bogus number, like whatever's in memory after the IREMOVE queue instruction. Because if it's an IREMOVE queue, you know, there's something here that we're going to get from the instruction memory that we just don't care about. Other questions? Follow-ups? Okay, so we have moving to a register. Almost. We need one more thing, which is that we need to increment the PC. So sometimes we want to add 2, sometimes we want to add 10. So we'll implement that functionality. So for IREMOVE queue, we'll add 2. For IREMOVE queue or IREMOVE queue, we'll add 10. And this is our complete only executes moves processor. And sort of the idea you should get is that, well, I sort of showed you this technique where we built step by step of saying, let's add an instruction now. So I just look at, okay, what does this instruction need to do? If that conflicts with what the other instructions want to do, we add muxes to make a choice there. So we said, oh, I'm adding this IREMOVE queue instruction. It conflicts about what register it wants to write to with the other instructions, so we added a mux. It conflicts about what value it wants to write to, so I added an option to a mux that already is there. And I just look for cases where I needed to do that as I was adding the instruction. And that's going to be our general process. So if you wanted to add queue, you'd follow the same idea. What registers do you want to read from? Can I already do that or not? If so, not, you need to add a mux. What register do I want to write to? Can I already do that or not? If not, I need to add a mux or extend a mux, and so on. Now, something to note. So here I've shown a solution where IREMOVE queue uses DESTY. So an alternate solution, which is what our textbook does, decides instead that they're going to use DESTM for IREMOVE queue. So DESTM is going to be the thing wired to source A. And they don't use DESTD, and that means that our data memory output, rather than going to this mux, goes to next our DESTM. So these are both correct ways of implementing this. And our textbook's logic is that they just have all the memory instructions use DESTM to write the value, and all the other instructions use DESTD. Now, in this case, we would still need muxes. Why would we need muxes? Can someone tell me? We still need, I should say, this mux. Why would we still need that mux? Yeah.
We need to set it to register 15 when we don't want to write to it.
Yeah, so we need to not write in the case because, you know, there's still going to be something here that's probably not the value we want to write. So we still would need a mux to say not to write, and we also want a mux here, so when we're executing our IREMOVE queue, we don't write to 2 registers instead of 1. So the textbook strategy doesn't reduce the number of muxes we need, really, but, you know, it is arguably a cleaner way to do things, but it uses the extra write port, which I've just avoided because we don't need it yet. Thing I mentioned earlier, we only really need it for the pop instruction. So questions on our move to register CPU? Okay, so our next step is going to be, well, let's just do all the move instructions. So there's one we omitted, which is the RMOVEQ instruction. So let's add that. And so the way I think about this is I say, okay, what is the RMove key instruction want to do? It wants to read RA, so we need to read RA. And we want to read RB, and we want to access memory at D plus RB. So this all looks great. We are accessing memory, computing the right memory location. Our addition there is adding D and RB already. Great. That's exactly what we want to do for accessing memory for R move Q. And we're reading RA, which we need because we're going to write it into memory. But to write it into memory, we need to attach something here, right? So we're going to need to add this attachment. And how about some other things? So we think about not doing things we don't want to do. So we don't want to write a value to dest. So in order to add this MRMoveQ instruction, we need to have a write none option for dest. Right, we can't write to a register because that's not what the RMoveQ instruction does. And we also need to make sure that just because we've attached something here, that we don't always end up writing to memory, because we don't want to suddenly make the RMoveQ instruction edit memory. So we're also going to need something where we control our memWrite bit. Remember that write enable signal based on what opcode we're running. So we end up with our rec none, our data in connection, and something controlling that write enable signal so we don't write for all the other instructions. Okay. So questions about our move processor? Okay, that's where I will finish up today then. See you on Thursday.